in Montreal. The F-Files is coming up next.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and this is the XX Files, the show about women using and abusing technology. On today's program, we're going to hear a talk given by Professor Donna Haraway at McGill University back in February. Professor Donna Haraway is professor in the History of Consciousness program at University of California in Santa Cruz. Her seminal work, Simians, Cyborgs, and Women, The Reinvention of Nature, has become the authoritative text in the theorizing of politics of the post-human, the cyborg, the techno-mythological ideal, and its promised utopias. In this talk, she goes beyond the female cyborg and talks about its companion species. Have a listen.
We've never been human. Companion species in nature cultures or encounters in nature cultures. I am, of course, in clear debt to my colleague and friend Bruno Latour, who wrote a provocative little book called We Have Never Been Modern, exploring the particular ways in which the beliefs that people tell themselves, the stories that people tell themselves about modernity and about history, are founded in systematic kinds of self-delusion, and what's going on in the world is truly much, much more interesting. The title We Have Never Been Human refers to an effort to explore ways of doing category work, of inventing categories, of participating in mutating inherited categories that somehow truly get the point that we are a crowd, that what it means to be human is to be in co-constitutive, obligatory relationship with many sorts of entities, including other species, as well as artifacts, built environments, non-built environments, landscapes, that to be who we are is to be in relationship, as opposed to be man who excludes those who are not himself. That to be human is precisely not to be that entity who is defined over and against that which one is not, be that something animal, human, the gods, the machine, the child, the woman, the person of color, the colonial other, the long and truly endless list through which the narrative of the autonomous subject has been produced through the philosophical and political tradition which we have all inherited. So with many others dealing with our technologies and artifacts as well as other organisms, I am participating in an effort to try to think through what happens if we really get it at a serious level, that we have never been human in that sense. So I begin with a picture of a dog. This is Jim's dog, given to me by a colleague, Jim Clifford, as he was taking photographs on a walk in Santa Cruz in a Greenbelt area a few months ago. What a perfect moss, fern, fired redwood, redwood needle, ponderosa needle dog being. The fungi, viruses, and bacteria we can't see, but they make the photo glow too. Millions, probably billions of living critters, the fingery eyes of a superb cameraman. Fingery eyes is a term introduced by a graduate student I work with to talk about the particular kinds of relationships between camera person, marine scientist, and marine critters in encounters in ocean environments that are multiply mediated by different kinds of fluids, multiple refractive indices, talking about the gliding together of the haptic and the visual, using the figure of fingery eyes. I think a marvelous figure for thinking about what vision is truly about, as opposed to vision as that which distances us from what we see. The visual and the haptic are truly in a kind of tight braid. Fingery eyes of a superb cameraman, digital critters of several kinds, including the camera itself, the modem through which the JPEG was sent to me, my own software in my own computer, the printer, the multiple kinds of digitalized apparatuses that makes Jim's dog possible, including the old-fashioned slide technology, because I refuse to use PowerPoint. For many reasons, some of them poor. Okay. Also, we have a base of long-dead wood sculpted by fire and loggers. We have greenbelt land policies of the 20th and early 20th century around towns like the city of Santa Cruz. We have early 20th century promenading practices, all converging to embody literally an attentive dog in a wintertime California coast urban woodland. I think this is what the philosopher Whitehead meant by a concrescence of prehensions. Now, I contrast that dog with Leonardo's dog, the Vitruvian dog, the dog of perfect proportions, the dog who shows us the Fibonacci series, androgyny of the kind that Leonardo was so interested in, the dog who illustrates for us in his perfection the join of art, science, money, and genius. This is, of course, a play on the Vitruvian man, which shows up, for those of you who have followed the history of genomics and post-genomics, among a small set of power images, which will include Vesalius's dissections, Michelangelo's creative touch, an occasional Picasso, and the Vitruvian man to grace the conference brochures for biotechnological conferences that also join science, money, genius, and art, and the body, in the way that Leonardo did, figuring late modernity as Leonardo was used to figure early modernity within that narrative self-delusion that Bruno Latour wrote so elegantly against in his book, We Have Never Been Modern. Now, I use the Vitruvian dog as the sign of humanism, but I need to do one more excursion. I have a sneaky feeling this should be higher. Let me back up and see if I can get this to mount the screen. I can't, so I'm going to have to tell you what this says. We have here a meeting of the American Association of Lap Dogs. You can see the lap dogs all sitting more or less in a kind of moot court converted conference room like yourselves. I regard you as kind of surrogate, almost good enough canids, and therefore worthy of being addressed in a serious fashion. The speaker says, "Ladies and gentlemen, behold the enemy." And we have there the laptop computer. Now, the humor of this, of course, depends on an oral pun, but the humor depends primarily on a particular kind of structure of anxiety that throws the person who believes himself to be human and modern between technophilia and the embrace of the machine, as well as the anxiety that the machine is taking over and becoming superior to its inventor, on the one hand, and biophilia, on the other hand, with its nostalgic lust for nature lost, on the one hand, and fear of biological determinism and the biological takeover of that which is uniquely us. Mind somehow will resist genetic determinism or some other form of the domination of nature. So that this cartoon fundamentally depends on the structure of the anxieties that both Latour's book and my work are working in a kind of struggle with. Now, Jacques Derrida, in the last several years of his life, thought about virtually nothing else but animals, which, of course, is what allows me to have a certain kind of sympathy reading him that I had not had in previous of his remarkable writings, which I read because I felt like I had to. All of a sudden, I truly needed to and wanted to, and found one of the best philosophers among us, one of the thinkers who, inheriting the Western philosophical tradition, reading layer of text upon layer of text, has taught us in really compelling ways how structures of signification, how structures of meaning-making work through those kinds of binary oppositions that constitute each other, and how the possibility of remaking meanings could work through excavating the binaries in such a way that they could never be used in the same way again. Mind-body dichotomies, male-female, animal-human, many others, the structuring dichotomies of the Western philosophical, political, scientific, and indeed popular cultural traditions. Now, when Derrida turns his attention to animals, in the context of 1997 lectures, 8 one-hour lectures he gave in 1997 that have been published in French and are beginning to appear in English in the last few years, he was commenting on the Cartesian animal-machine problem. That was what centered his meditations in these 8 one-hour lectures, and conducted detailed inquiries into philosophers such as Levinas, Spinoza, Descartes, Lacan, and so forth. All of them have at least French-sounding names, even if they perhaps had origins in the German landmass. You will not find a North American Anglophone type among them because of our general lack of theoretical sophistication. That bothers me considerably less than what I will talk about later, which is the absence of actually existing biologists in the context of this remarkable set of discussions of animals and animality. But for the moment, staying with this cartoon, I want to point out what Derrida had to say in relationship to a 1967 paper by Jacques Lacan, the subversion of the subject paper that has been addressed in a number of contexts. Derrida points out that the conception of the human from a psychoanalytic point of view rests on a series of three panics in relationship to primary narcissism, that sort of narcissism that takes oneself as the center of the world. Okay? The three kinds of primary narcissism that psychoanalysis and theory indebted to psychoanalysis has attended to are, first of all, Derrida points out, the Copernican, that illusion of being at the center of the cosmos that was broken in historically contentious chapters of Western history that are still memorialized in such things as Galileo's trial and much else. The extraordinary chapter of history that produces the first wound to primary narcissism as in this kind of reading. The second wound to primary narcissism is the Darwinian. That is to say, a human being is not at the center of the living world any more than it is at the center of the cosmological and astronomical world. The third is the Freudian, that human consciousness is itself not what it thought itself to be within these traditions and does not have either self-knowledge or self-certainty. And the unconscious on the one hand, or what cognitive sciences and neurosciences show us on the other, that the workings of the human cognitive practices, the possibility of human conscious being, is dependent psychoanalytically on the unconscious and biologically on the body itself, and indeed is the body itself in its kinetic action. That we will call the Freudian wound to primary narcissism. And I think we need to add, in honor of this cartoon, the synthetic or cybernetic wound to primary narcissism, that which human beings have built, the technologies themselves, that we are not unique in relationship to apparatuses or technologies either, and that our technologies turn out to be surprisingly lively, even as we are distressingly inert. Okay. So these four wounds to primary narcissism are part of the critique of humanism, in which I see myself one of the laborers in the vineyard. Now, however, I no more want to be post-humanist than I ever wanted to be post-feminist. I have no desire to go postal in relationship to the history of humanism. But in the spirit of my teachers, such as Derrida and others, I wish to somehow go elsewhere, though I think my real teachers in this are in Star Trek and science fiction writers, who actually got very good at worlding elsewheres in ways that I think fuel not just imagination but scholarship. But I think I owe you some deeper discussion. Now, in the context of a program like the history of science in the first place, and then the history of consciousness in the second, I discovered myself to be something of a member of an alien species. That is to say, a biologist, lapsed. To be true, to be sure, I was a lapsed Catholic, a lapsed biologist, never quite faithful to the one true church, but nonetheless with a subject formation that did not fit readily either in the secular humanist university or in the departments of the interpretive social sciences and the humanities. I discovered as I learned about theories of subject formation and semiotics and the rest that my subject formation was, in a very serious sense, as an organism. That, of course, I had a subject formation as a subject of a state or as a woman of a particular kind of class and situated national setting, but that fundamentally I found myself to be in the world in important ways as an organism, and have tried to think through what that might possibly mean. Therefore, I identify with the wolf wearing the data collecting pack with the little bit with the aerial that indicates that she's sending back data to some kind of remote data collection and processing receiver. And she's being introduced to the wolf pack by another wolf who says, "We found her at the edge of the forest. She was raised by scientists." Now, put that together with the following slide. A wolf can be a girl's best friend. And those of you who are anthropologists might recognize the MacArthur Prize-winning Faye Ginsburg as the little girl in Life magazine being kissed by her father's research subjects, the wolves at the Jackson Memorial Laboratories in Bar Harbor, Maine, that wonderful institution that gave us, according to Karen Rader's beautiful book, the standardized laboratory cancer model research mouse. The Jackson Laboratories are an absolutely crucial institution for the apparatus of biological knowledge making, and in particular, the apparatus of biological knowledge making in relation to standardized research organisms. Also, it was a key site, really the key site, for the early investigation of the behavioral genetics of dogs and then of wolves. Benston Ginsburg was Faye Ginsburg's father. The wolves were his research organisms. So the kind of double play on raised by scientists, raised by wolves, is my allegory of belonging, of a kind of Clifford Geertz cockfight sort. For spending the rest of the time today on the whole talking about dogs. So my point of view is inside biology in a way of examining both the discourse and the fleshly semiotic material entities of the critters themselves. I'm interested in emergent nature cultures, that is to say, nature cultures is one word. I'm interested in the ways these two kinds of categories don't so much mutually constitute each other as implode into each other in ways that require us to learn to make distinctions differently. Okay? Well, if I have said something about point of view, I do apologize for the light issues. It was either me or my slides. Okay. I think that I need to tell you something about my theoretical perspective, for which I go to this advertisement from Combinex, since bought out by Ciba Geigy. So I am immersed in the multiple kinds of buyouts of transnational capital. And this is this advertisement for a flucoside vermicide for sheep and other herbivores, which is, of course, a reversal. It kind of flushes the intestines of worms and flukes of various kinds. So there's a kind of scatological joke. The humor of this slide depends on a scatological joke and a joke on reversals. But it also depends upon that man that you can't see on your left, who is an international sheepdog trial champion, Thomas Longton, who owns the British sheepdog trial winners, the Border Collies, who are featured there in the center of this Combinex, then Ciba Geigy ad. Thomas Longton agreed to have a ewe penning his Border Collies in precisely the reversal that plays on his fame as the international sheepdog trial champion. And what you also can barely see is another flock of lambs over the stone wall. This particular visual image was one of the early kind of quasi-Photoshop meldings. It was one of the early visual graphics manipulation programs that melds in the ewe from another photograph altogether, melds in the rear field of the other sheep, and several of those border collies are the same animal. In reverse poses of each other. So it's an entirely synthetically composed photograph of a reversal. Now, it's that kind of juxtaposition and ironic relationship to reversals that I have found to be a particularly potent kind of intellectual tool in examining things that I love, just as Thomas Longton loves these border collies. Where one is tempted to sentiment of a kind of cloying kind, or tempted to a kind of puritanical outrage of a kind of puerile kind. These kinds of serious joking intellectual modes of attention serve one well. Now, lest you think the reversal stopped there, this is a very poor quality photograph because it circulates on the internet in a very low information density JPEG. Well, actually, it circulates as an internet photo that you can download, unattributed. I originally wanted to deal with this because we have here the Lancashire countryside, left is to right is, and so forth, compared to the last one, but we have an airbrushed Dutch windmill on the Lancashire countryside for yet another kind of invented landscape. I was trying to trace this image, that's how I found the other one, through border collie culture on the internet. I went to the Border Collie Internet Museum. I was tracking the sheepdog trial people to see if they could track me, if they could get me who the human was or who the dogs were, because I wanted copyright permission to print this. So I was caught up in an intellectual property circuit in an effort to use the image without getting sued down the line in publication. These are really parables for talking about the immersion in commercial culture, the immersion in the invention of various sorts of property, the production of visual culture, the multiple kinds of linkages that dogland is, that I use as a way of both living in and thinking through the multiple kind of crowd who we are. Okay? Now what I would like to do is begin to introduce my concept of companion species by setting up some conversations between philosophers and biologists who I think need each other to think well about emergent nature cultures, about co-constitution of meaning and flesh, about the inhabiting this planet together with other critters, particularly other animals in my concern here. So I want to return to Derrida's commentary on Lacan's 1960 piece, The Subversion of the Subject and the Dialectic of Desire in the Freudian Unconscious, to another part of his argument in that piece, in which he notes that Lacan, in writing about the human-animal relationship and the Cartesian machine, introduces initially a note of hope that perhaps the high wall between human being and animal being will be lowered in psychoanalysis and in philosophy and in critical theory. But the promise is not delivered upon. The promise, there is a kind of betrayal of the promise. Lacan, for example, discusses the kind of work that indicates that at least some of the social mammals and possibly some of the other organisms who have been studied, some of the birds certainly, are capable of practicing deception on their experimenters. You probably all know the classic experiments that were done with chimpanzees, for example, whereby a chimpanzee who liked some experimenters and disliked others was in a room in which food could be hidden underneath a cup, in a row of cups, and the experimenter the chimpanzee didn't like comes into the room and the chimp assiduously stares at the empty cup so that the experimenter will not get the food. The experimenter whom the chimpanzee likes enters the room and the chimpanzee looks happily at the cup that has the food in it. Subsequent experiments you can, of course, immediately imagine. Can the chimpanzee pretend to pretend so that since the chimpanzee will assume that the experimenter will assume that the chimpanzee is looking at the wrong cup, if the chimpanzee looks at the right cup, the experimenter will assume it's the wrong cup, and so forth. Human beings have been particularly good at upping the bar and going meta on any criterion of what counts as cognition that's shared. And indeed, in this particular set of experiments, people went ballistically meta. And Lacan went ballistically philosophical in the Cartesian mode at this point and begins to discuss the difference between that which is human and that which is merely animal, is that no other than us has the ability to pretend to pretend, that it is precisely in that self-reflexivity, that meta move, that then distinguishes the human from everybody else. Now here I think Derrida makes one of his most interesting contributions to contemporary ways of ways of rethinking animal-human relatedness within philosophical traditions. He says, it is less a matter of asking whether one has the right to refuse the animal such and such a power, speech, reason, experience of death, mourning, culture, institution, techniques, clothing, lie, pretense of pretense, covering of the tracks, gifts, laughter, tears, respect, and so on. The list is infinite. And the most powerful philosophical tradition within which we live has refused the animal, about which more later, all these things. It is less a matter of that than of asking whether what calls itself human has the right to rigorously attribute to itself, to man, which means, therefore, to himself. I misread that. What he refuses, the animal, and whether he can ever possess the pure, rigorous, indivisible concept as such of that attribution. He goes on to point out that precisely that attribution of positivity is what constructs ourselves over and against the rest of the world. We attribute to ourselves a series of qualities that pay no attention to the consequences, do not take seriously those four wounds to primary narcissism, except in a panic mode, in attributing to human beings a whole series of capacities which may or may not be empirically true, but which continue the operation of constructing that which is us by expelling the other. Now, from this point of view, Derrida goes on to the next piece, or rather I set it up in that sequence, which he titles The Animal That Therefore I Am, More to Follow, a piece that shows up in English in 2002, Critical Inquiry, in which the first words are naked in the first place, and follows an extraordinarily moving exploration of nakedness, particularly philosophical nakedness, over and against the regard of animals. He says, this animal, looks at us, and we are naked before it. Thinking, perhaps, begins there. He constructs a little story of himself getting undressed in the evening and his cat standing in the door of the bathroom. You think a little bit of Foucault's reading of the Las Meninas paint a portrait on Les Mois des Choses. You have the kind of framed doorway with the little cat watching the philosopher getting undressed. Kind of echoes. Never mind. Derrida is getting undressed. His cat is looking at him. Derrida insists that we pay attention to the fact that this is a real and particular cat who is actually looking back. In other words, he is interested in actual regard. He's not interested in the figure of regard in order to conduct as a kind of philosophical alibi for what follows. But what he pays attention to from that extraordinarily promising moment on is his experience of both sexual and philosophical shame. Wonderful writing on both those subjects, but I assure you, we do not hear from the cat again. Okay? We have no idea what the cat might possibly have meant looking at Derrida, although I am personally willing to assert as a nearly certain matter that the cat didn't give a flying damn about whether Derrida was naked or not, and cared precious little about philosophical shame, and whose own sexual ideas did not deal with the concepts that Derrida was struggling with for the rest of the article. Why did the cat disappear? Particularly in the writing of a philosopher who in that very same article points out that the whole concept of the animal was precisely one of the things that had crippled the tradition of Western political theory and philosophy for centuries, that no philosopher, which is true only if you don't read a whole host of feminist philosophers and many others, that no philosopher, up until Jacques, he's really not quite that arrogant. Nonetheless, that's the way the writing goes. No philosopher had taken seriously the problem of the category of the singular universal, the animal, and certainly did not take seriously the actual living heterogeneity on this planet as a philosophical problem. For dealing with questions of consciousness and signification. Okay. Derrida notes this in this article and indeed calls the category of the animal not just a logical error, but a crime, a criminal act against the animals.
You have been listening to a talk given by Professor Donna Haraway at McGill University back in February of this year. Donna Haraway is a professor in the Influential History of Consciousness program at University of California in Santa Cruz. Her seminal work, Simians, Cyborgs, and Women, The Reinvention of Nature, has become the authoritative text in the theorizing of politics of the post-human, the cyborg, the techno-mythological ideal, and its promised utopias. This has been The XX Files on CKUT 90.3 FM. Tune in every Wednesday at 11:30 for more about women using and abusing technology. Stay tuned for If You've Got Ears. X.
X.
I slept too little and drank too much. Anyway, get out of bed like this. Oh, Christ.
Rise and shine with CKUT 90.3 FM.